This is the State of Things, broadcasting live from Triad Stage in Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Southeast Asian refugees first arrived in Greensboro after the Vietnam War, and now, more than 40 years later, the city continues to welcome families fleeing violence. Three higher education institutions joined together to examine trends in refugee resettlement and contemporary immigration policy. Guilford College, Elon University, and UNCG's Center for New North Carolinians will host a day-long gathering. It's going to feature representatives of government, academia, and grassroots advocacy organizations. Shifting Worlds, Displacement and Forced Migration in Modern Times. It's going to take place this Friday at Guilford College. The organizer is Dia Abdo, an associate professor of English at Guilford, and she joins us now. Also, Leilani Rauten, who is executive director of the New Arrivals Institute. Leilani, welcome to you, too. Let me ask you, Leilani, about the population of refugees and immigrants arriving to Greensboro. How has that changed over the last few decades?
Well, when refugee resettlement first started, it was really focused on Southeast Asian, and over the years, as different needs have happened in the world, the populations coming have shifted. So, when I first started this work, it was still very heavily Montagnard refugees out of Vietnam. Then the attention turned a little more towards refugees out of Bhutan and out of Burma. But when you're looking at what areas of the world refugees are coming in right now, at this point, the vast majority into Greensboro are Congolese. A couple of years ago, there were a number that were coming from Syria, a couple years before that from Iraq, but as of right now, it's mostly Congolese.
I wonder what it was like when that first wave of refugees came to Greensboro, North Carolina. We're talking about the 1970s now, right? So this is a place that I'm going to guess was not used to a lot of influx of migration or immigration from other countries. Maybe it was. What was the landscape and what was the reception at the time?
When refugees first started coming to Greensboro, it was somewhat by choice. Leaders from Southeast Asia, from the populations that had fled, looked around the United States, and Greensboro was seen as a welcoming place. There is a lot of faith-based organizations in this town, but we also had a very strong furniture industry, so there were jobs here. But we also have some of the rolling hills, so it reminded Southeast Asians of their homeland. And so Greensboro became a resettlement site very, very early on in refugee resettlement in the United States. And once you become a resettlement site for one population, you're then able to build up capacity so that as new populations need homes, they are then brought in.
It's just interesting to think about it, a community that may not have had a lot of experience with newcomers, but was very open to the idea. And once people opened their arms and their hearts, then we figured out how to do it. And now we've become a place. And Dia, you've really made it a part of your life to transform campuses into a kind of landing pad for refugees. Tell me about that effort.
Sure. A college or university campus is kind of like a city within a city, right? Every campus a refuge, which is really built around the idea that a campus can act like a parish, inspired by the Pope's call for every parish to host a refugee family, and use its available resources, of which we have many, of course, to welcome refugees coming into that city. And so here in Greensboro at Guilford College, we've been hosting refugees on our campus and supporting them in resettlement. But the idea is to leverage those resources of many communities within the larger community.
Now, campuses are built, obviously, for young adults that start at the age of about 18. Families have very different needs. How do you sort of repurpose or fit the university and the campus to meet those needs?
Right. I'm not sure that they're necessarily very different. Campuses, especially small liberal arts colleges, have also been places where faculty members live with their families, and so we are very community-based. Because we're small, our ethos and just the way we operate is sort of family-oriented. And so what we're mindful of doing, of course, is making sure that the family's dignity, agency, privacy is respected. And so they live in housing that is dedicated typically to faculty, but every other resource that's available to students is available to them, like the library or the gym or the career center. Really, it is built for supporting people, and there are no people who are more resilient and more resourceful than refugees. So it's a great fit.
Leilani, talk about your group, because I know that the New Arrivals Institute is part of a transition process. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
So New Arrivals Institute, we don't actually do resettlement. We're considered a community-based organization that is funded through grants from the state of North Carolina as well as local grants. And our focus is really on education. So we look at assisting refugees and immigrants with self-sufficiency and U.S. citizenship through education. So our goal is to bring together as many partners as possible in the community. Maybe they have worked for years with refugees and immigrants, and maybe they have just realized that refugees and immigrants are here, but we're bringing them together to try and provide all of the services that are needed to surround that family so that they are able to take the next step. And our passion is to do it through education. So everything that we do, we look at it from an education bent. Is it just learning English? Is it learning job skills? Is it learning how do you write a check to pay your rent? All these different things that we take for granted, we try to provide that for them so that we're able to lift them up and, you know, really support them becoming contributors to our local economy.
Now, in the big picture, it really doesn't matter what the legal distinctions are between, let's say, immigrants and refugees when it comes to welcoming people and trying to meet their needs, particularly when they're under stress. But I think it's worth, at this point, making the legal distinction, and Leilani may be asking you what that is, and whether the needs of refugees and immigrants are different.
Mm-hmm. So refugees, they actually come to the United States with that status. They have fled their home into a third-party country. It has been determined by the United Nations that they cannot return home. There is a very long process, and you can read a lot about that online, but there's a very long process. They then are approved by the U.S. government for resettlement in the United States, and they come here with that. There's also a small amount of money that is provided to help get them started, get an apartment, things like that. But financial assistance is very low for them. When you're talking about an immigrant, they could come for a variety of reasons. It could be someone who crosses the border because they're coming here looking for work. It could be someone that is coming here to join family. And there are some who are documented, some who are not documented, some who are just here as migrants looking for work and looking to go home. But immigrants as a whole, and refugees are a subset of immigrants, are not eligible for all of the different programs that are available to refugees. So whereas they don't have access to some of the employment things, they don't have access to things like SNAP. When refugees first arrive, they are eligible for things like SNAP. But depending on their status, they may be able to go to work. Something else that we may see is some immigrants that come, they're very highly skilled. And in fact, some refugees that come, they're also very highly skilled. So there are similarities between those groups as well.
Dia, I wonder how the resettlement goes these days and even opening campuses when we are in the midst of such anti-immigration rhetoric in this country.
Right. And I think that's where the role of campuses really should be amplified. So we're trying to raise consciousness and awareness about a lot of the misinformation that's out there that conflates various populations with each other, and also reminds people, I mean, that this is a global catastrophe. There are 71 million displaced individuals in the world who are going through multiple points of trauma. You leave your home, that's traumatic because of violence, because of war, because of persecution. The journey itself is another point of rupture and trauma, right? So smugglers, people die because of capsized boats. I mean, so, and then resettlement in itself, if you're lucky to get resettled and you're not warehoused in a refugee camp for the rest of your life and your children's lives, is another point of trauma. And so trying to ensure that information is constantly out there to combat the myths about migrants and refugees is really important. It's where campuses can play a big role.
Leilani, what are you hearing from families, or how, or do they reflect or take on some of what they're hearing? Is this part of their lives? Do they ask you questions about, am I safe? I mean, how do they reflect this?
So the interesting thing about refugees and immigrants is that for the most part, our clients don't view themselves as different. They view themselves as the same. They recognize that their experience of coming here often is very, very similar. And when there is backlash against an immigrant population or Muslims or any single religion, our refugees recognize that this backlash is also directed at them, that when somebody is spewing hate about immigrants, they're not asking the person on the street, are you an immigrant or are you a refugee? Mm-hmm. So they really recognize that they are one population, they have the same needs, they've gone through very similar experiences, and it's just this document that says I'm a refugee versus I'm an immigrant that is different. But it does concern them a lot. And one of the nice things about the school that we have is the refugees and the immigrants, they see it as their location. So when they have concerns in the community, they come and they're able to come together and talk about it across ethnicities, across language bases, and come together as a community to figure out how are we going to react to it. When the Muslim ban was enacted, some of our non-Muslim clients said, I'll walk with you to the bus, I'll walk you all the way home, because they know that there is fear in the community and they want to help alleviate that for their friends.
That's interesting. Talk more about that solidarity, that because you can imagine that communities under stress like this might just want to circle the wagons and say, look, we've got our own problems, I understand mm-hmm. what you're going through. Well, one might be forgiven for focusing only on one's community, but are you saying that there's more cross-cultural solidarity here than I might imagine?
Right. I mean, I think in my experience, I've also seen how we've become Greensboro community members, right? And so what affects folks in Greensboro really affects others, and I think this institute is a testament to folks coming together from all of these sectors of the community, including refugee and immigrant communities here in Greensboro, to talk about issues that matter to them. Because at the end of the day, they've all faced similar experiences of being displaced and then trying to find home. And they understand that the health of one sector of the community is also mm-hmm. intersectional with the health of other sectors of the community.
You are a professor of English and an immigrant yourself, Dee, and I wonder how any of this story is reflected in your writing, or is it?
Yes, it is. So I do, obviously, academic writing, but I write fiction and creative nonfiction and poetry as well about the experiences of diasporic individuals. I'm a second-generation Palestinian refugee, and so the experiences of my own parents and my grandmother who fled Palestine to Jordan, and then my own experiences as an immigrant and the experience of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans finds its place in my writing creatively.
Leilani, you know, you talked about dispelling, both of you did, making efforts to dispel myths so that communities understand who they're welcoming in their midst. But the other part of this education process, it seems to me, is reflecting back to the community how much of an advantage and how many benefits they've received, which might go unnoticed from immigration over these decades. And I wonder if that's any part of this story or if there's any effort to tell the story of immigrant contributions to Greensboro and the larger community.
Absolutely. There is a pretty consistent conversation that goes on between agencies that work with refugees and immigrants, but also empowering refugees and immigrants to tell their own story in various locations and in various methods so that their story is out there. But when you look at the community, and we're talking to people who are government officials that just work in regular businesses, we're talking about not just things like having a multicultural society being a benefit, having multiple languages in our schools being a benefit, but we're also talking about economically what is the benefit of having these people here. And back in 2017, there was a national study done by the Department of Health and Human Services that showed that over 10 years, refugees, just refugees, contributed more than $63 billion more to our economy than was actually spent helping them. If you're looking at just the Triad area, in the last 3 years, refugees, just refugees, have opened more than 200 businesses, small businesses in this area. So there are definite economic benefits to having them here. And when you look across the nation, immigrants, not just refugees, they open businesses, start small businesses and even large businesses at twice the rate of our citizens. So really, it is an incredible opportunity that our nation and our cities need to be taking so that we can grow as a community together, working together, and not seeing, oh, you're a different ethnicity, but just saying you are my friend that lives in my city.
And it's an important part of the American story from the start. Dee, yes. I would talk about this conference. You're bringing mm-hmm. together a lot of people. What are the focal points of this conference?
So understanding, first of all, what's happening right now in terms of policies and practices. What are the conditions of the detention centers at the U.S. southern borders? What are the current policies regarding refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants? And then we would sort of want to funnel in into the effects of that trauma, especially on mental and physical health. So the conference will sort of funnel down to that. What are the mental health issues that are being faced specifically by refugees and immigrants in the U.S., but in North Carolina? And then what are the initiatives and support available to those community members? And then finally, we'll end on personal stories to uplift the agency and the individuality of folks who are experiencing this trauma and also the joys of such a journey.
I want to thank you both for being on our program. Dia Abdo is an associate professor of English at Guilford and founded Every Campus a Refuge. Leilani Rauten is executive director of the New Arrivals Institute, and you can find out more about their work at our website, stateofthings.org, and the Shifting Worlds Institute this Friday at Guilford College, which features music by Quilla. You'll hear her in a moment, but thank you both, Dia and Leilani, first of all. Quilla, you're going to hear in just a second as we close out our show. You can check out Quilla's workshops for women's electronic DJs and see her perform at the Pinhook in Durham on February 23rd. This is the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hull of Mormon. Jenny Lawson's our technical director. Al Wadarski and John Hardy helped engineer the show today. Josie Taurus is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia. Once again, the music of Quilla. Boom, ba-da, boom, boom, ba-da, 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 ba-da,
your hand. You're so beautiful, I can barely stand, I can barely watch, but I still hold your hand.